Good morning, universe, and welcome to another day, redeemed from death and looking forward to life because of what our Lord Jesus Christ has done for us. You're listening to Sharper Iron, waking you up every morning with the law and gospel of the living God, drawn straight from the text of Holy Scripture for you, all a part of your morning drive for the soul here on Worldwide KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, Senior Pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Rockford, Illinois. And on this Friday, the 26th of October, we're in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 35, continuing to learn how by faith the prophets, as well as many other men and women of old, received the promises, waited by conviction for what God had said, and saw miraculous things take place. Today, again, women received back their dead by resurrection. Who is that? And how does that encourage us in our hope in the resurrection, which has been purchased for us by our Lord Jesus Christ? To help us through this morning, we have on the line Pastor Matthew Wheatfeld. He is the Director of Admissions at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Welcome back to the show, Pastor Wheatfeld. We've spent quite a bit of time here with the groups, you know, every single day with the guys, trying to wrestle with this question. I think I'm finally coming down on my own answer on this one, but, you know, are we supposed to see people that are different, that haven't been mentioned in the list of events that are taking place, or is this really listing those who have been mentioned? And I'm increasingly convinced that the answer is the prophets. Yes, we're supposed to see the other prophets that have not been mentioned, but we're not necessarily supposed to go on and see a bunch of other people beyond those prophets. But that's just my hunch at this point as we wrestle through that. Do you have any thoughts about that or about the general prescription here as well, that this whole thing is to drive us to faith?
Yeah, obviously the whole thing is to drive us to faith. But yeah, I think it's supposed to give us a broader view of the prophets, not just the specific ones that are mentioned, but just the broader view, those who have carried us, carried the faith forward, not being able to see what the culmination of that faith meant in the person of Jesus, but that they were the ones delivering a message that was timeless and that really carries now them forward and carries us forward, receiving salvation, receiving the thing that they only saw of in a dim or unclear way, that we now have full grasp of, that we know exactly who the person of Christ is and have faith that he is the one ultimately that saves us.
The other theme that has come back again and again, and I was thankful to be reminded of it yesterday as well, is resurrection. Now today it's in the text really plainly, but going all the way back to when Abraham is first mentioned, or Joseph as well at the start of the chapter, who has his bones taken back to Judea, and not really called Judea yet, the promised land at that point,
yeah.
Because he believes he's going to rise from the dead there, and he wants to be with his family when he rises from the dead. The idea of the resurrection being a Old Testament faith that is what all of these individuals were clinging to in the hope of a Messiah, in the hope of a coming king who would save them from it. That's something that at least it was lost on me personally. I don't know, maybe everyone else out in the world, all you listeners out there, you're like, oh yeah, of course, this is all about the resurrection. But I wasn't. I was like just thinking it was just faith. But faith in the resurrection when it is to come, and that theme is so huge through these names and through these stories.
Oh, for sure. I think it's something that's very easily overlooked. And I mean over you know, not thought of in its fullness, even by myself. But yeah, I think it's even in that, in those first words of gospel spoken in Genesis chapter 3, that the Lord would send one who would crush the head of the serpent. Even in those words, I mean, I think that we're still looking forward to now the resurrection. That sets the pace, that sets the tempo for how our ancient fathers, our fathers in the faith, and the prophets lead forward with their message in order to share that good news, not just of the salvation, but yeah, as you had said, of that we will be resurrected also.
So 35 then talks about women receiving back their dead by resurrection. And it's not talking about the resurrection on the last day. This isn't like a that they by faith already have them and they're dead and they're waiting for it. This is a pointing to actual miracles. And at least in my mind, there's one particular one that just pops up in the Old Testament. Like, oh, I know which prophet that was, right? But you've come up with another good list of things, and you push us all the way back to Abraham and Isaac first. I think that's really interesting. Especially because Abraham's not a woman.
Exactly.
But it's a good place to start. It's a good place to start because it's really where the chapter and the idea of resurrection starts in a lot of ways. So why don't we go back and kind of pick up that idea? What are you getting at there?
Yeah, so kind of in my thoughts for today is not just I don't have just women listed in here. And the reason being is in many ways that this is as the writer for Hebrews writes, he is also looking at I think a broader scope too that is very important to take a look at. And so I do push us all the way back to Genesis chapter 22 with Abraham and the sacrifice or the faux sacrifice, whichever way you want to talk about that, of Isaac. And Genesis chapter 22 starts off with that the Lord is planning on testing Abraham. And so he calls to Abraham. Abraham says the good words of faith, "Here I am." And the Lord gives him a command. Go take your son to Mount Moriah and offer him up as a sacrifice on the mountain to which I will tell you. So already at the beginning of Genesis chapter 22, it's not like the Lord holds back his plan for what's going to happen. The Lord's already laying out the plan for what's going to happen when we get to this mountain. And so they go on a three-day journey and finally get to the mountain, and Abraham tells the servants and leaves the donkeys, and it's just he and his son. And they go up the mountain, and finally Isaac says to his father, Abraham, where, we have the fire, we have the wood, but where is the burnt offering? And Abraham, through faith, says, the Lord will provide a lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And I think in many ways, this is also kind of a foreshadowing of the crucifixion. When Jesus prays, if there's another way to let it, to let this your will be done, Father, let it be. If not, in many ways, like the faithful words of Abraham, here I am, to be that sacrifice for the atonement of the sins of the world. And so Abraham builds the altar. He binds Isaac. He lays him on top of the wood, and he reaches out his hand in order to kill his son. The text says slaughter his son in the ESV. And the angel of the Lord calls out to Abraham to stop him. And again, good, faithful Abraham crying out, here I am. And the angel gives him the message, don't hurt your son. Look up. There's a ram caught in the thickets. Use that as your sacrifice. And finally, Abraham calls this place the Mount that the Lord provides. So the name of the mountain is the Lord provided, past tense. And so I really like this this Bible story, especially in the eyes of that them receiving back their dead by the resurrection. Because in all intents and purposes, in Abraham's mind, his son is as good as dead. Hmm. His son is, the Lord gives a command, and faithful Abraham goes along with the plan and goes along with the will of the Lord, regardless of whatever might be going on in his mind, like, why would you do this to me, Lord? You have promised me a son. You have promised me not just a son, but you have promised that I will be the father of a great nation, that my offspring will be as numerous as the stars in the sky or the sand in the desert. You've promised this, Lord, but now the one who you have given to us, to my wife and I, in our old age, now you want to take this one from me by my own hand. But Lord, I trust, I have faith in your promise. I have faith that you have the greater good, the greater that your will be done through this. And so I follow your plan, not knowing where it goes, but only that, as the prayer says, that your hand is leading us and your eye is guiding us. So he goes along with this plan, knowing that his son in many ways is as good as dead. And the Lord, in even just a literal sense, raises him up, pulls him up off of the altar, off of the wood, before he is killed, and then replaces him instead with the ram. So that's the reason why in many ways, as I was reading through this text, it brought me straight to Genesis chapter 22 with Abraham and Isaac. And I think it's a great kind of foreshadowing, a great even typological look forward to Christ and his father, where Abraham, where the Lord calls for Abraham to follow his will, and Isaac is obedient even to the point of death, though he does not have to see that. So then, and then is replaced ultimately, but Christ, who is obedient even to the point of death, even death on the cross, Titus that speaks in that way, that ultimately then Jesus does die. There is no replacement, and so that's Jesus is then the culmination of this typological event.
Bringing up the typology there, or the shadow of Jesus and his cross cast backwards over the story. You can see his actions, his life, his person, his work, all those things in the sacrifice of Isaac, but as through a mirror dimly. That's something else we've been trying to pick up on in all of these stories. I feel like we maybe didn't do it as good as we could have, maybe in the last week and a half or so, kind of lost sight of that. So easy to do, and yet I'm convinced that's really another major point that the book or the author of the Hebrews wants us to pick up. When he talks about Melchizedek and he talks about the temple and how one greater than these is here, he's trying to drive us to this typological, or it's not symbolic in the sense where the Old Testament's a symbol without a true history, is that the true history actually is also a symbol. Like God had the power to do both at the exact same time. And Abraham and Isaac is one of the most clear places for that, as Isaac carries the wood on his shoulders and the ram in the thicket's got thorns around his head and it's all that kind of stuff there. But but when I'm reading along in Hebrews 11 and I'm looking at these listings, and I've tried to admit this pretty straight up, like when it says things like escape the edge of the sword, I'm like, I don't really know who that is. But but then it comes to like stopping the mouths of lions, I'm like, oh, Daniel, that one's Daniel, right?
Yeah.
Women receive back their dead by resurrection. I can't help but think of the widow at Zarephath, Elijah and the widow. And your mind just kind of has to go there because it is, within the Old Testament, a signature event. Yes, the sacrifice of Isaac is a signature event. It's big, but it's really not a miracle, right? It is. The angel talks to him and all that kind of stuff, but like it doesn't quite stand out the way, say, that the 10 plagues are signature in this sense. They're super miraculous, the crossing of the Red Sea. But even with all of that, to my knowledge, like, this is the only resurrection in the Old Testament? Is that right? It's awful close. It's certainly the only one done by the voice of a prophet. And so Elijah is sort of seen as the greatest or one of the greatest prophets, in large part due to this miracle. When Jesus speaks with Moses and Elijah on the mountain, so we might think, because of the way we read the Bible, oh, the two great prophets of the Old Testament, Moses and Isaiah, right? But no, it's Moses and Elijah. And a lot of it revolves around the fact that he raised somebody from the dead. This is just such a huge deal. So anyhow, you want to kind of start digging into that in any direction you want. But in my mind, this is just we underestimate the power of this story for the Hebrew mind. Let's say it that way.
I would definitely agree. We definitely do underestimate the power of this story specifically in the mind of the Hebrews, simply because I think, yeah, like you said, Jonathan, we oftentimes, when thinking about the great prophets, we oftentimes do leave out Elijah and instead insert Isaiah. And so, yeah, I think we do ourselves a great disservice, but the minds of the Hebrews, I mean, even to this day with the modern Jews, and even in their not necessarily Old Testament based, but maybe in a little bit with some hearkening back to the Passover and their current Seder meal, they still do leave a seat open, not for Isaiah but for Elijah. So in order to be there with them in remembrance. So, I think even in the mind of the modern Jew, at least the conservative faithful remnant that there might be there, Elijah still is a key figure in the whole of their faith. So we're looking at 1 Kings chapter 17 specifically. And I'm going to pick up at verse 17 and just explain out a little bit, what exactly is going on in this specific part. Elijah has just provided for the widow in the way of creating more flour, that the Lord through the word of the Lord spoken by. Through the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. Now, flour and oil have continued to be in abundance for the widow, the widow's son, and Elijah. So Elijah has already done a miracle of sustenance, that is, a miracle of sustaining people's lives. So which I think is quite important as a lead-in. It's not like these individuals, the widow and the son, are on death's doorstep. They've been provided for by the Lord already and by the prophet. They've got food in their bellies, and so they're able to, it's not like Elijah comes up on the scene and then the son is dead. He's already been taking care of them. So I think that actually makes this an even more significant and part of the story, just because then that the Lord has provided for them, and now the Lord will continue to provide. But going on to verse 17 and following, the widow's son gets sick. He comes down with that is so severe, as the text says, that he has no breath left in him. I love how the text says that he's dead. There is no breath, and the breath that they're speaking of. And I forgot to look this up in the Hebrew, but I'm guessing that's the same word for the same word that would be like spirit that sort of breath. So the breath of life is no longer in him. And so the widow comes at Elijah in a way of, how can you do this to me? How could you take my only son? How could you, man of God, do this? How could you let this happen? And he calmly, in many ways, reassures her and asks for the son, takes him in his arms, carries him to the upper room, to the upper chamber where Elijah was lodging, and laying him on his own bed. Let me read now, starting at verse 20. He cries out to the Lord, "O Lord, my God, you have brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I am sojourning by killing her son. Have you done this by killing her son?" And so he stretches himself upon the child three times, crying to the Lord, "O Lord, my God, let this child's life come into him again." And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child came into him again, and he was revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper chamber into the house and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son lives." And now the woman goes on to speak good news and to speak good words about Elijah. She says, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth." So this confirms for her now, beyond that of the just sustaining the family, sustaining and taking care of them through the food now that he is a man of God, and that the word of the Lord is in his mouth, and that that word is truth. And so it's really just amazing to see how it is that the Lord works through the cries, through the prayers of the prophet, and the prophet Elijah here, and how he now, the Lord raises him on Elijah's account, on because of his prayers, because he hears the words of Elijah and raises him because of that. And it's not a partial raising, but it is a full blown resurrection. It's a full that he's back, healthy and revived again. The woman sees him and exclaims with joy that the word, that his word is truth, because it comes from the Lord.
Pretty key to see that Elijah's response is a little bit of consternated himself, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like he hears about the child being dead and he's like, oh, no problem, got this, here we go, right? Instead, he goes and he has his own dark moment of the soul. You know, Lord, why have you done this? So to see then the common pain too, I think too often, this is a bit of a tangent, but we ignore or forget that being a Christian does not mean that we're not going to die, our family's not going to die, it's not going to hurt when they do. And as a parish pastor, you know, I always kind of watch people I care about go through the grieving process, and there's just a part of us that wasn't ready for it, kind of didn't think it was coming. And Elijah's going through some of that too. I mean, even Elijah, when he sees this, he's like, wait, what? You know, how's this happen? And yet then he goes up and he prays. And this is kind of key, though, that he prays. He does not command the child to get up. And maybe as we move forward and look at Jesus a little bit later, this will make more sense, but don't miss it. He does not just say, I can do this thing. I've got this power of God from God. Rather, he prays. He asks God to do it. Oh, Lord, let this happen. And the Lord listens to him. And that's pretty potent stuff. On what promise was he praying on, kind of is the question that I have to ask, right? If Hebrews has wanted us to look at how women receive back their dead by resurrection as a matter of their conviction in the promises, I guess perhaps it is that she knew that Elijah was a prophet of God. And so even as she's kind of berating him a little bit, she's at least going to the right place, right? She's like, I said, well, if you're the prophet of God, tell me what this means. So there is that. But I also want to, feel free to respond to that, but I also want to hedge just a little bit here, because we always really need to do this in our present charismatic age. This is not a story that tells you the power of prayer. If you just pray hard enough and long enough and right enough, look, you can even raise the dead with your prayers. And that might seem like that's a little out there for you, listener, but it's not out there. There's teachers out there that teach that kind of thing. And then don't miss that most other teaching about the power of prayer is the same false teaching, telling you that if you just pray hard enough, you'll get what you want, right? It's not the promise we have while we're waiting for our Lord to come back. We have a promise that he hears us. We have a promise that he holds all things in his hands. But he hasn't promised, well, miracles for everybody. And that gets back to, this was the only one of these things in the Old Testament. It wasn't like everyone got miracles back then either. Pretty rare and extreme when they did happen. Thoughts?
Yeah, I definitely think you're spot on with that, especially in regard to the power of prayer. In many ways, you know, the woman's faith is commended in regard to as you said, going to the right place at the right time, and not because of her work though, but because she knew that he is a prophet. This is who he is, and being a prophet, he's already taken care of them in their time of need through petition, through request, and he takes that as a good man of God. He takes that request not to himself, not to try to deal with these things himself, but to handle them through the Lord, to have the Lord do this for them. And for even in the earlier incident, it's not Elijah creating more flour and oil, but it's the Lord creating more flour and oil and not letting that flour and oil leave or subside or do anything like that. But it's all the Lord's work and not Elijah. And here too, it's Elijah simply being a good man of God, being a good one who knows where to turn likewise, and that turning to the Lord, even in consternation. I mean, there are many a time that a pastor might come to the Lord in consternation, knowing that in his heart that, you know, the Lord will take care of these things, but I just don't see how it's going to work out. I've experienced that myself. Nevertheless, still turning to the Lord in these times, as opposed to turning inward, turning to someone else, turning to a false idol, turning to your works and the works that you trying to make this work out. It's like whenever I start getting into the loop of I don't need the Lord here, I can do this myself, I think back toward Moses. And Moses, when as they're moving along, the Lord tells Moses to speak to the rock in one incident, and instead Moses hits the rock, trying to do it his own way, and the Lord is not pleased in that, for the Lord had given instructions as to how it was done his way as opposed to Moses's way. And I always think back to that, and that the Lord has my people's good in mind, and he'll take care of it. And then also to your other point, Jonathan, in regard to the power of prayer, modern evangelicalism has done the church a great disservice. Especially groups that preach a prosperity gospel. That is, if you know, you can tell God's favor by the amount of stuff, the amount of blessings that you have, and that if you simply have enough faith, if you pray in the right way, the Lord will bless you or continue to bless you. And so the implications are, well, if I do have a lot of stuff, obviously the Lord loves me. Obviously I'm doing the right thing, and the key phrase is I'm doing. Whereas if it's the Lord who blesses both the righteous and the wicked. But on the other side, then, if you don't have plenty, or you don't have the extravagant life, one could also think, well, clearly I'm not doing the right thing, and again, the key phrase being I'm doing. So it's a slippery slope, and we've got to stay, you know, in the right mind that it's not our work, it's the work of the Lord, and the Lord will bless in the way that He sees fit. Not if we pray in the right way or giving us what we want all the time, although sometimes, you know, those prayers are answered in that way, but that was the Lord's plan the whole way through. The Lord tries to conform our will to His will, to humble us in order to show us what His holy and divine will is that He plays out in our day-to-day lives. And that's something that we ought pray for also, that He would continue to share his the light of His knowledge with us, so that we may see what His will is and do according to that, because it is what he has in store for us.
Sometimes you can't see how it's going to work out, and sometimes this is just the thing, Christian. Sometimes it doesn't work out. Sometimes His grace is sufficient, and the resurrection from the dead in Jesus Christ that's coming at the end of the day, end of your life, end of the world, that's the working of it out. And honestly, that's the better thing. Sharp Ryan will be right back. Stick around.
Thy strong word bespeaks us righteous, bright with thine own holiness. What an unspeakable blessing to be able to open the scriptures together every single day and spend time listening, pondering, and proclaiming what they unfailingly reveal, God's great love for you and me in Jesus.
Thy Strong Word, weekday mornings at 11 on Worldwide KFUO. Underwritten by Lutheran Heritage Foundation, lhfmissions.org.
Do you feel like you are just a character in a bewildering story at the mercy of an unreachable author? This week on the Lutheran Hour, Dr. Michael Ziegler says your life is really a great work of nonfiction by an author who truly loves his creation. Hear Dr. Ziegler this week on the Lutheran Hour.
Sundays at 12:30 and 5 p.m. on Worldwide KFUO.
The NLS Braille and Talking Book Program gives patrons with visual or physical disabilities the freedom to read their way.
If you want to read in electronic Braille, you can. If you want to read on your phone, you can. If you want to read in hard print, you can.
Everybody can read the way they want to read using this program.
For more information about the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped Library of Congress, visit loc.gov/thatallmayread.
Listening to KFUO on your smartphone is so easy to do. Smartphone assistant, play KFUO.
Playing KFUO radio.
You can also visit the place where you get your apps and download the KFUO app.
You can also go to the KFUO homepage.
Wow, the KFUO homepage is customized to fit your phone with an easy-to-find listening button.
When you're on the webpage, you can browse for more information. You can listen to KFUO 24 hours a day at KFUO.org. Don't forget about Facebook, facebook.com/KFUO radio.
Now you're just acting like a know-it-all.
By faith, women receive back their dead from... I just read that about as poorly as you possibly could. By faith, women receive back their dead by resurrection. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 35a, just the first part of that this morning here on Sharper Iron with Pastor Matthew Wheatfield. He's Director of Admissions at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Any special events coming up in the next couple of weeks or months here at the SEM?
Yeah, we're actually day one of our Christ Academy College. So we've got a bunch of college students running around here having a good old time with us in worship, in our teaching, and having some fun as well. So that's the big event. We last weekend had our Prayerfully Consider, and there's another one coming up in March. So anyone interested in checking out what we do here at the Fort, March 13th through the 16th. You can get onto our website, ctsfw.edu, and just search up Prayerfully Consider.
So you're not the only one so far, but you're in the minority here. Of those who, when I give you this little snippet of text and say, go figure out who this is or who you think this is referring to, and let's talk about it. Most people have stuck to the Old Testament, but there's been a few of you that are like, nope, New Testament too. And yeah. So we've got a few New Testament references here. In my mind, again, the widow's son at Nain is the big one, yeah. In part because she's the parallel to the Eliza passage in a lot of ways, and in part because she's a woman, right? And the other two individuals are both men. But if you'd rather start with the centurion's servant because it's earlier in Luke's gospel, we can start there too. How do you want to start picking these apart?
Yeah, why don't we start with let's start with the centurion's servant. And if we do have time, it could be fun also to go into John's gospel and look at the raising of Lazarus, giving him back to women, his sisters, Mary and Martha.
Right. Well, we shall see. Luke chapter 7, verses 1 to 10, the centurion's servant. Take it away.
Sounds good. So in Luke chapter 7 begins with this centurion coming to Jesus. He enters Capernaum, and a centurion comes and says that his servant is sick, and sick even to the point of death. And this servant is highly valued by the centurion. So the centurion is a high ranking military officer, one that would be leading a group of soldiers, and so he comes straight at Jesus, and has been hearing about what Jesus has been doing throughout the whole of the countryside and what exactly it is that he's doing. And then he comes to Jesus and begs him and asks and asks him. The text says he pleads with him earnestly that the people are pleading with Jesus to go to the synagogue, but Jesus wants to take care of this of this individual's friend. And so even when Jesus is still out from the house, the friends of the centurion say to the centurion, don't trouble the master, leave him alone. But the centurion says that, you know, even at your word, you can heal my servant. And so he goes on to talk about how he understands the way that powerful people work. If he who is a centurion tells one of his soldiers to go, they go, and if he tells another to come, they come, and so on and so forth. And Jesus marvels at this, that the centurion understands who he is and how he operates, how he works, and even to the point of saying, "Hey, I've not seen faith like this even in Israel. So go, your servant is well." And he returns to the house, and the servant, he finds the servant well, the text says. And so I like this this incident as kind of as we have been going through Hebrews, dealing with faith, and now looking at the faith of this outsider, this outside individual, a faith that Jesus himself commends as something that he has not even seen within Israel, and how this individual now, out of love for his servant, is pursuing the true master for healing here. So I absolutely love looking at this text talking about faith, talking about especially the power of the word of Christ, that he can say, go, your servant will be well. And the servant, he finds the servant well. So it's both the power of the word and the faith that the Lord alone can give, can produce within individuals. That is just is truly, truly amazing.
And then he's going to follow it up then in Luke 7, 11 through 17 with a definite resurrection event. So we move from a healing of someone near death to a resurrection. You've already brought up, but it's going to be seen again, I think, the significant difference between Jesus and Elijah here, in that Elijah asks and Jesus commands. So one greater than Elijah is among them in a significant way, so much so that even those who didn't want to believe it had to believe something crazy was going on. You know, either he was a great charlatan or a great sorcerer. And yet behind that, you know, get past the faithless response to this, and you can see that the God who Elijah prayed to is now standing in the flesh, going to raise back a woman's son and give her back to him, to her, by the power of the resurrection that is within him. I absolutely adore this story. Again, Luke 7, 11 to 17, one of my favorites. It's a battle of light against darkness, too. It's so cool. So what do you see in it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I again, as you had mentioned previously, that this is the parallel to Elijah, to the Elijah incident that we had looked at on the first half hour of the show. And the woman, Jesus comes to this town Nain. So he's gone from Capernaum to now coming into this town of Nain, and he and his disciples and a great crowd. A great crowd is following him as well. So he's not just doing this kind of off in the wilderness by himself, but there's a lot of folk that are around that see this, and it's very important, because then those people eventually leave when he gets to the take up your cross and follow me. There are a lot of people witnessing this. Oh, excuse me. And so as they come into the town, they draw near the gate, and a young man has died, he's being carried out. and he is the attributes of the individual, just of this woman, continue to pile up, and you just feel sorry and more sorry and more sorry for her. So her son is dead. The text says the only son of his mother, and she's a widow. So this is not just this, not just a son, but this is the only son. The only son of a widow, which means this woman is as good as dead as well. No one to take care of her. So not only has one person died, in many ways, now two people have died. Because there's no, in ancient Middle East culture, the husband or the sons would take care of their mother. As women were not able to work outside or run businesses, things like that, they were reliant on their husbands or their sons to take care of them. So now this woman, one, does not have a husband who is, because he has died, and two, does not have a son since her only son has now died and is being carried out of the town. And a crowd, there's a considerable crowd around her as well. Whether they're friends, whether they're family, none of that matters. But ultimately, the Lord sees her. And in his seeing her, and I'm sure hearing the murmurs of who this woman is, and the Lord in his omnipotence also also knows that who she is and has compassion on her. And I love that compassion word. I know it's a word that has been batted around a lot, not just on this radio broadcast, but also just in general through President Harrison. But that Splunk needs Omai, that compassion that he has on her, that turning of the stomach feeling that just makes you want to reach out literally and help someone. And that's exactly what Jesus does. He tells her not to weep. And he comes up to the board in which the boy is laying on, her son is laying on, and stops the bearers. And he says to the young man, I say to you, arise. And the dead man sits up and begins speaking, and Jesus gave him to his mother. And this just, the text says, fear seized all the people. Fear seized them all, and they glorified God, saying, a great prophet has arisen among us, and God has visited his people, that is who Jesus is, Emmanuel, God who dwells with us. So that is kind of, they are right with that, but they get the first part wrong, that Jesus is more than just a prophet. And the report spreads throughout the whole of the countryside, and they continue. Jesus and his disciples continue to go on. And then the next part that comes is John the Baptist's disciples come to Jesus and tell him begin to talk to him. But that's neither here nor there. The great thing is kind of holding the Elijah incident and now this widow's son at Nain incident side by side. How do the two of them work together, or what are the differences? The differences would be that Jesus, as you said, Jonathan, Jesus is the one speaking, whereas Elijah prays to the Lord that he would help out here. It is actually Jesus who speaks to the widow's son at Nain and tells him to rise. Elijah, the text says, brings the boy to his mother. And it's really interesting the detail that's given here in Luke 7, start at verse 15, and the dead man sat up and began to speak. So now you know that this young man is truly alive. Not only is this some sort of like rigor mortis that, you know, the body stiffens and causes some sort of knee jerk reaction, causing this young man to sit up. This is life. because he begins to speak. And he gets off the board, he gets off the beer, and is given to, and Jesus gives him back to his mother. And it's really amazing to kind of hold these two in parallel to each other. And the responses of the widow from Elijah and the widow now here at Nain, or sorry, the crowd here in Nain is very similar. That they see this, the crowd sees this prophet, whereas the widow says she knows his word is truth. She knows he's a man of God because he's done this for her. So it's really interesting to see how their responses really are very, very similar to each other, and how Jesus is only acknowledged as a prophet here. That the people can't make that next step. In some ways, the people are used to hearing about the prophets, and they can handle Jesus as a prophet, but they can't handle Jesus as the Messiah. And even in that saying, God has visited his people, it's more that the presence of God, that his spiritual attributes, that he is flowing through this individual Jesus, so that he can even raise the dead. So I think holding those two accounts in parallel to each other are absolutely really interesting.
Well, and just on that last bit, that a few verses before, the centurion, who's not a Hebrew, he seems to know who this guy is, right? Mm-hmm. He does. I'm a man under authority. I know who you are. I think at least that's the implication there. But so then you also see, I mean, we got about 5 minutes left here. I don't know how you want to try to tie this thing up, whether you want to look at Jairus and his daughter and how that connects, or whether you want to jump to the raising of Lazarus, or of course, at least just to say right now, the other edge of the typology of the widow with Elijah and the widow with Nain and Jesus is that both of those are pictures of what Jesus has truly come to do, an only son who dies and rises. And then, believe it or not, he sits up and starts to talk, right? He starts to say stuff, which is pretty important. Baptize in my name, that kind of thing. So, again, with about five minutes left here.
Yeah, let's go there, Jonathan. Even in the death and resurrection of Jesus, these two accounts find their culmination in him. He's the only, as you said, the only son of his mother, of Mary. And in many ways, whereas the widow's son here at Nain is as good as dead, Mary, though, remember at the cross, Jesus gives responsibility for caring for her over to John. Then at the cross, woman, behold your son, man, behold your mother. So now that John then takes her to live with him and takes care of her. But, jumping forward then, after Jesus dies, Jesus not only is raised, it preaches before his brothers, is there actually with the disciples preaching and teaching. He asks for something to eat in John's account. So this isn't just some sort of phantom. This isn't some sort of ghost of Jesus. This isn't some sort of spirit. This is Jesus himself eating with them and showing them the marks in his hands and his feet and his sides. And so it's in many ways and Jesus isn't. Typologically speaking, I think Jesus isn't necessarily given back to his mother. He's raised from the dead, but not given back to his mother per se. But he's given to now his bride, the church, and shared with us through his word and through his sacraments, where his death is now showered over us in the font of holy baptism, where he actually shares with us his body and his blood to eat and to drink, to give us as one of our early church fathers said, the medicine of immortality, that he forgives us of our sins and leads us on into life everlasting. And so that when we die, we have the promise, likewise, of being resurrected as well, just as he was. For all things that happen to Christ happen to us as well. He lives, we live. He died, we died. He is resurrected, we are likewise resurrected. He sits at the right hand of the Father, so we sit at the right hand of the Father as well. That's the life of Jesus, is the life of the Christian, and the life that is given to us in the Christian life.
Pastor Matthew Wefelt is pastor at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, talking to you about Hebrews chapter 11, verse 35, how women receive back their dead by resurrection, and tying it, of course, to the resurrection of our Lord. Mary getting to see him rise from the dead, but not only Mary, all of us, which means that you and I will also receive back ours, baptized into Christ on that last day from that old evil foe and enemy, death. Thank you, Pastor Wefelt, for being my guest this morning on Sharper Iron.
Thank you, Jonathan, and pleasure being with you again.
Absolutely. Resurrection. It's all about resurrection. I don't know why I've always missed that coming through this section of text, Hebrews chapter 11. I mean, I knew Abraham. I would even go there to prove that verse, right? Oh, look, when I teach on Abraham in Genesis 22, I'll teach that text. I'll go to Hebrews and say, look, see, he believed in resurrection. It says so right here. But to see that that's what's going on behind each and every one of these stories, behind Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David, Joseph, Moses, Isaac, all of these individuals had the same promise that you have. That promise was the promise given to Eve, that from her would come one who would defeat the curse, who would defeat the one who brought them into the curse, who would beat down the devil, who would throw him down like lightning. And of course, that is then who Jesus of Nazareth is. So the only difference between us and them is that we now know his human name. And that really is it. We know his human name, and we have seen it come to pass, that it is witnessed to in history that what they were promised is now accomplished on the cross. And we join them in looking for the fruit of that cross, the finality of that accomplishment, the recompense which will be paid out, righteousness and justification for you, when he comes again to raise you from the dead. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk. You're listening to Sharper Iron. I look forward to waking up with you at that dawn.